and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. Our subject this month is actor Edward G. Robinson. Born in Bucharest in 1893, Robinson's family emigrated to the U.S. after the children experienced anti-Semitic attacks from their schoolmates. Arriving in New York in 1904, Robinson later said, "I was born again on Ellis Island." The young Emmanuel Goldberg planned to be an attorney, but an interest in performing led him to winning a dramatic arts scholarship. After changing his name and serving in World War I, he started performing in the theater in 1913 and then film, where he debuted in the 1916 silent Arms and the Woman. He played his first gangster in a 1927 play, which led him to be cast as one in the 1927 Claudette Colbert mystery, A Hole in the Wall. While many actors of his generation saw their careers collapse with the advent of sound, Robinson flourished, making 14 films in just 2 years. He became a star in 1931's Little Caesar, a Warner Brothers gangster drama. He would soon go on and co-star in films with fellow rising stars James Cagney, Humphrey Bogart, and Bette Davis. In 1939, he starred in Confessions of a Nazi Spy, the first American film to portray Nazism as a threat to the United States. Robinson would volunteer to serve in World War II, but was rejected because of his age. He remained an active and outspoken critic of fascism during the war. In 1944, he co-starred in Billy Wilder's classic Double Indemnity, which many consider the first film noir. He also starred in other film noir classics like The Red House, Scarlet Street, and The Woman in the Window. He worked with Orson Welles in The Stranger and John Huston for Key Largo, his last of five films with Bogie. He was called to testify in front of HUAC because America, and even though he was cleared, he was nevertheless graylisted, which led him to appear in smaller, lower-budgeted films where he was often the only star. He got a boost when Cecil B. DeMille cast him in the 1956 blockbuster The Ten Commandments, which led to a return to more high-profile roles, like co-starring with Frank Sinatra in A Hole in the Head, Kirk Douglas in 2 Weeks in Another Town, the entire Rat Pack in Robin and the Seven Hoods, and Steve McQueen in The Cincinnati Kid. He screen-tested with his friend Charlton Heston for Planet of the Apes, but Robinson's declining health led him to turn down the role due to the extensive makeup he would have had to endure. His health declined even further in the early 1970s, but he managed to finish one more film, again with his friend Heston, 1973's Soylent Green. Here with me to discuss Soylent Green and the career of Edward G. Robinson is podcaster and muckraker, Max Romero. Hi, Max. Welcome back.
Thanks so much, Rob. I'm happy to be here. I'm excited to talk about this.
Yes, absolutely. I had to call you a muckraker because you are. You're a journalist, and I don't know that many people that are journalists. So plus, I love old-timey terms like that, so it's perfect. Thank you for coming back. You are only one of three people. Well, I guess technically four. David Iskudiris did a special episode. You are only one of four guests that have appeared on Fade Out more than once. So whoever that means to you, congratulations, I guess.
It means a lot to me. I'm anxiously awaiting my jacket.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be very cool. It's satin, it's blue, it's got my logo, it's got the show logo on the back. It's terrific. Patreon.com/FW podcast. You were part of the early test shows, sort of. I did the first five of Fade Outs to kind of see if the format would work as a show, and I wanted to have you on early on because I knew you and I have are great friends, and even though we have never met, I think that makes the friendship even more special that we're as close as we are despite the fact we've never actually hung out together. Yeah. And so I wanted to have you on the show early, and because the show we did together about Heath Ledger I thought was terrific, I've always wanted to have you back. And so I'm fascinated as to why you picked Edward G. Robinson. Like, what? I mean, he's a great actor, but what is it about Edward G. Robinson that, like, that's the one you wanted to talk about?
Well, okay. So Edward G. Robinson is one of those actors, at least for people of my generation. I don't think it continued past. I'm Gen X, so I don't think it went past, you know, people my age, our age. But Edward G. Robinson was one of those people who was kind of always in the culture. And that was because of Looney Tunes. Looney Tunes was my introduction to the character of Edward G. Robinson, you know, of that gangster, that Little Caesar type of gangster that he made his own, that he made basically the template for that kind of gangster in that era. And over time, I also I was I'm a big fan of noir films, and I love him in Key Largo. I think he's fantastic. Every year, I don't know if this was around the country or not, but I remember every year they used to show the Ten Commandments at Easter,
Sure.
and so I watched that every year, and I loved him as what is his name? Denon? Dan something?
Who's your Messiah now?
Exactly.
He practically has a cigar in his mouth in the middle of the movie.
Exactly. But one of the revelations for me was when I saw him playing a good guy in The Stranger, which is that Orson Welles film, and he plays I believe a federal investigator,
Yeah,
and
tracking down
he
Orson Welles, who was an escaped Nazi hiding in
right
America.
right and that was so different to me, and it was and he did so well that kind of sent me down a path of watching other Edward G. Robinson movies and kind of really appreciating what a great actor he really was. And as you know, and we've talked about this before on other shows, and I don't think it's any secret or surprise that I'm a big sci-fi fan. And my parents, my dad especially, would sit me down in front of these classic sci-fi movies, especially once VHS became a thing. And Soylent Green was one of those very 70s kind of sci-fi
Oh,
movies
God, yeah.
that really just kind of hit hard. And rewatching it, you really see how Edward G. Robinson is such a big part of why that movie works.
Well, yeah, we're gonna give Soylent Green its due later on in the show because very like that is a very famous movie. Obviously, it's buried into the culture thanks to just one line
Right.
in the movie. And very and not always when we do these shows, does the actor in question, go out on a kind of a big movie like that? And so in this case, we do have that. So that we are absolutely going to spend a good amount of time on Soylent Green. It's funny that you mentioned because yes, you and I are roughly around the same age. We're both Gen X, and it's funny that you answered a question I had for you before I even asked it, which was, what was your first experience with Edward G. Robinson? Because a lot of these actors, a lot of these performers, you don't really remember where you first saw them. Like they were just sort of there. Like I can't tell you the first Bogart movie I ever saw. But the reason I am able to pinpoint where I first saw Edward G. Robinson is for what you just said, because of Looney Tunes. That's absolutely what it was. And because the first time I ever saw him or some version of him was in the Bugs Bunny cartoon Racketeer Rabbit. That's the name of it. And he's not Edward G. Robinson, but he's not named that, but he's a gangster and he looks like Edward G. Robinson and he talks, yeah, shade, man. And then he's got an assistant who's like a little Peter Lorre type. And it's as a kid, I would quote that particular one over and over again about the whole, like the one bit of like where he's Rocky and he starts giving out the cash from the loot and Bugs, is like, how about me, boss? And Edward G. Robinson's like, one for you. And then of course, Bugs Bunny starts appearing as different people with different voices and he keeps getting paid every time. What about me, boss? One for you. I'm me, boss, one for you. And eventually the entire pile of money is in Bugs Bunny's hand. And that was, I guarantee that was the first time I ever saw who, I was like, okay, I don't know who this is. He's just like a gangster, I guess, right? And then I saw whatever movie I saw and I went, oh, that's who that is. Like, okay, thanks, Bugs Bunny. But it was, yeah, it was you and I are same like that. But it's clearly Looney Tunes watching it on like early. They used to run Looney Tunes weekdays before, and I would watch them before I went to school. And they always play like the same eight ones over and over again, but they always play that one. So yes, that was where it was. And I always wonder, like I was not able to find out. Like I wonder what he thought of that, right? Right? Is it a compliment? Is it? I don't know. Maybe I could see you having a sense of, hopefully if you have a sense of humor about it, you're like, oh wow, look at me, I'm in a cartoon. Like, that's how famous I am. I'm in a cartoon. But that's absolutely it. Was Looney Tunes was the beginning of knowing who he was.
You know, and he's, I mean, it was so, I in doing research for this movie, I came across, I had completely forgotten about it. I'm sure Chris knows all about it, but he does one of the window scenes in Batman, the TV series.
Yes, that's
And he
right.
talks about his art
His art
collection and
collection, yes.
yeah. And you know, all that sort of thing. And it's kind of like he had what, a 70-year career, which is amazing. You know, I mean, who can say that?
60 years, right? Because he was first in
Something like,
19, his first movie is 1916, and his last movie is 1973. So that's a 57-year film career. Pretty
which is,
amazing stuff.
yeah, that's insane. And you know, so you know, he must have had something going on. Because I mean, it's not like those, I mean, that Bugs Bunny cartoon you're talking about, I don't know, it's probably from the 30s,
I think it's
right?
40s, probably early
40s,
40s,
you
something like
know,
that. Yeah.
and here I was watching it 30 something years later.
Yep.
You know, I mean, that's an indelible mark you're making, you know.
It really is. By the way, I'm glad you mentioned Batman, because we generally don't talk about TV roles in the show. We kind of keep it to the silver screen. But I wanted to mention Batman because, it mentions his art collection, which I thought was really funny, though he was that famous for having an art collection that, like, they would make a joke about it on Batman. But it's kind of remarkable because when you watch Soylent Green, I mean, we all, like, nobody knew it at the time. He knew it, but the cast didn't know it. Like, he was very ill at that point. And he didn't look great. And part of it is nobody looks great in that movie on purpose. Everybody's sweaty and, they got because they're living a hard life. You know what I mean? So he doesn't look good. But when I watched the, I rewatched the Batman episode that he's in. It's one of the Green Hornet crossover episodes. And he looks phenomenal. Like, he looks hearty and healthy, and he has this little goatee. He looks so good. And I'm like, wow, just like 7 years later, he's gone. And I'm like, that I was shocked at how part of it was the Batman lighting. I think everyone looks good in the Batman lighting, right? Those beautiful gels that they put on everybody. But, like, he looks, he just he that is not someone that I would say he's going to be dead in 7 years. You know what I mean? Like, he just looked absolutely amazing. So, and I like that it's such a weird, like, he was not a really, like, it's not like he was that contemporary a figure to be on Batman, right? That's like the hippest thing in the world, but yet there he is. I love it.
I mean, I didn't dive that deep into it. I'm not sure what he was doing at the time, but it couldn't have been that, you know, that big
No,
at the
right. I mean,
time.
they were getting younger people and stuff, or people that were on TV at the time or things like that. But yeah, it's I love that. I do love that cameo. I mean, I have to think, oh, what did he think about that? Like, what was he? Probably his grandkids were like, "Grandpa, do Batman." Okay, all right, I'll do whatever this thing is. What is this thing? What am I doing? So anyway, we're going to talk a little bit about some of his previous work before we get to Silent Green. So I'm going to go. We'll go back and forth. You can just name whichever one you want to talk about. We can go back and forth. I'm going to go first. But the first one I watched, I didn't watch any of the Silents. I have to admit, I didn't get to any of those. But the first one I watched was his first big hit, which was Little Caesar, which I mentioned in the intro, the Warner Brothers gangster film. And that's a great movie. It's kind of, for anybody who hasn't seen a lot of pre-code studio movies, they are an eye-opener of how grim they are. Right, and how adult they are, and you'd see, like, Hays Code got in and like, no more of this stuff. And one of the things that I was struck by when I watched it is the gang that he's this he's little his name is Rico, and he shows up, and he basically is like a gangster wannabe, and he basically crowbars himself into this gang, and then starts making his way up the ladder by being more ruthless and being smarter and being gutsy, and he basically takes over. I'm sure they were all lovely people, and I don't mean to insult their families, but, like, all the actors they found to play the gangsters, they look like Dick Tracy villains from Dick Tracy. These guys have faces that you're like, these guys were like, I'm going to Hollywood. With this mug, I'm going to Hollywood. They look like they are there, like they are extreme looking dudes. Let me put it that way.
It was a different
And
time, Rob.
yeah, it was a different time. And he just, and well, that's the thing. It's like they don't make movies like, they don't put people like this in movies anymore that look like this. And that's a shame because everybody's gorgeous. You know what I mean? Everyone looks like either Glenn Powell or Sydney Sweeney. And it's like, no, you can have people that are strange looking. And he's terrific in it. He dies at the end. He has the famous line, "Is this the end of little Rico?" He talks about himself in the third person. It's a dynamic performance, and you can see why it made him a star. And it's funny if you think about, like, again, don't mean to be, you know, but like he's not classically handsome, and his voice is not smooth to the ear, and yet it made him like he was like, no, I'm a movie star. And that's because audiences were a little more accepting of what they thought of movie stars. So it's just a great, you know, intro performance. And you say, oh yeah, this guy just eats up the screen because these other actors are great in it, but he is dominating it partly by his character, but his charisma. He's just in there and just boom. So I just thought that was a terrific movie. Have you seen that one?
Oh gosh, I saw that a long time ago. I have not seen it in years, but I do need to revisit that one.
Okay.
That's a yeah, you know, and that's something we'll get I'll talk more about with when we talk about Soylent Green. But yeah, he Edward G. Robinson has oh, he just has charisma to burn, you know, and he really any scene he is in, he becomes that center of gravity. You know, I don't think it was the first movie that I saw him in, but one of my favorite movies, one of my favorite Bogart movies, and one of my favorite Robinson movies is Key Largo, which is just, you know, top to bottom, stacked with talent.
Lauren McCall.
Beautiful. You know, and just beautiful looking. And, but, you know, I mean, so you have Lauren Bacall, you have Humphrey Bogart, you have John Huston. And you know this cast of really strong character actors, you know, because back in those days, you know, character actors could, you know, were what we would consider a movie star today. And but Edward G. Robinson is just everything is orbiting around him in this movie. And you know, yes, you know, Bogart and Bacall, you know, that was that whole thing, and that was, you know, arguably their movie, but I would also say that Robinson probably in a big way stole that stole that movie from them, because everything circles around him. Everything happens because of him. And his character is, you know, a gangster character, but there's this quiet menace that he was so good at. And like I said, you know, in The Stranger, that's what made that such a revelation for me, was because it was I was used to that, and then to see him being kind in a different movie and being smart and, you know, all those things that he had to be, was really just eye-opening to me. And you know, he's Johnny Rocco in Key Largo, and it's one of those movies that if I catch it on cable, I end up watching the whole thing. Because I just can't stop watching. I just can't stop watching him. You know, he's just so great. And in my head, I always hear "Soldier, hey soldier," you know, and it's just, you know, like you said, that voice was not a strong voice. It wasn't like a melodious voice or anything like
No,
that.
no.
And you know, and his looks kind of look. He looks like his face was molded out of putty, and you know, and he just.
Our apologies to the Robinson descendants.
Yeah,
We're
sorry,
very, very
Robinson.
sorry.
You know, we all know it's true. And he, but for some reason, he made all that work for him, you know, you know, and you kind of see this in Key Largo, where it's not so much about looks or even smarts, even though he is of a very smart man. He's a very clever character in that movie. But what a lot of what it is just this sense of power. And he really kind of carries that in a lot of his movies.
I could see too that as an actor, you might not you well not you're not going to turn it down because it means it's an A-level picture. But I could see being an actor of his stature that you would be maybe a little nervous about being in a movie with Bogey and Bacall because they had such unbelievable chemistry. Obviously they did. They had an on-screen chemistry and a personal chemistry
Oh,
that
yeah.
I could see if you're playing sort of the third of a movie where they're the other two, you're like, is anyone even going to pay attention to me? These two, smoldering on screen. And yet that's right. That's someone of his level of personality that he doesn't disappear. That movie, when I think of that movie, I think of that movie as a triangle of the three of them. I don't think of it as, when I think of like To Have and Have Not, I think of just Bogey and Bacall, right? But it's Key Largo. No, Edward G. Robinson's in there and he's given it as good. And that requires someone of, again, real force of personality to be able to do it.
Yeah,
So
and I think another movie that I actually didn't answer your question. I think the first movie I actually remember seeing him in was actually The Sea Wolf.
haven't seen that one. Okay. The Jack London book, right?
Based on Jack London. It's a sailing movie. He is basically a very domineering, iron-fisted sea captain. And there's a lot of stuff going on in the background and all this, but it's just one of the, I think what it, one of the things that people maybe don't realize about Edward G. Robinson, because it's very easy to overlook, especially if you're like us and your first exposure was to a caricature of him, is that you kind of expect him to be chewing the scenery all the time, and he really doesn't. It might seem like that because you're just so drawn to him, but a lot of his acting is fairly subtle. It just shows what caliber of an actor he really was.
Yeah, absolutely. I watched another one of his gangster movies called Smart Money, which is the only film he did with James Cagney. I was so sure
Oh,
that,
wow.
like, oh, with Bogey, he must have done like five of these with James Cagney. And no, he didn't. He just did the one. And it's when James Cagney was still kind of relatively unknown. So, but by the time the movie came out, Cagney had then done Public Enemy and became a bigger star. And so on the poster, they make them look like it's a two-hander. And it really isn't. Cagney is in the beginning. And then he kind of comes in at the end, but it's mostly Edward G. Robinson's movie, which is kind of funny because it's like that was a marketing decision that Warner Brothers made, or whoever made that movie made, I think Vitaphone or whatever the old timey label is in front of that movie. That was a marketing trick that the studio tried to pull 90 years ago, and it's still working on me in 2025, right? Because I'm looking at like what other movies of his have, and I see I'm like, oh, Edward G. Robinson and Cagney together? I'll watch that. And then it was like, oh, where did James Cagney go through half of them? But anyway, it's an okay movie. Again, Robinson is good, and he plays, he's sort of dishonest, but not really. It wasn't bad. Of course, we've all seen Double Indemnity, just an absolute masterpiece. And I think that would actually be a nice double feature with The Stranger, because it's Edward G. Robinson as avenging angel, right? He's the guy who's trying to stop the main character, in this case Fred McMurray, and then in The Stranger Orson Welles, but he's this guy, and he doesn't seem like somebody who is going to be like a kind of man of action that's going to take down, in Double Indemnity's case, a murderer, and in Orson Welles in The Stranger's case, a Nazi, an ex-Nazi on the run. And yet he is kind of indefatigable in both those movies. And he has a speech in Double Indemnity that he makes insurance sound like a true calling. It's really amazing. My dad worked in insurance his whole life. I don't think he ever really thought of it that way. Edward G. Robinson's character is like, he gets so excited at the idea of like, giving people coverage with the insurance. And yet it's like, but the people that are cheating the system, we're gonna get them. And it's like, wow, man, he's really into this. This is the most exciting claims adjuster I've ever heard in my entire life. It's fantastic.
And those are, again, two classic films and two of my favorite movies. And I mentioned Ten Commandments, which is one of those big epics. Everyone is chewing the scenery, including him in that one. But I love it. It's just, so many great performances that have kind of sadly kind of slipped under the radar. Because like we said, what an almost 60-year career, and he worked, fairly steadily, and but a lot of these movies just kind of fall by the wayside, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, right. It's just more and more things to, take up people's time. It's like some of these movies that you grew up on, like Double Indemnity is like that was like a movie that I was just famous when I was a kid. Like I just knew what I heard it. I knew what the term meant because the movie was just such a big thing. And even though, and nowadays, like a lot of people have maybe not heard of it because it's, I think you have to be like kind of a film fan to really know what it is. By the way, as an aside, just because I'm a huge Orson Welles nut, I love the idea that The Stranger, which was also directed by Welles, was like Orson's attempt to make like a straight ahead crowd pleasing movie to prove to Hollywood that he wasn't this like, artiste who lost money. And it's like, even when he's trying to be commercial, Orson Welles can't help himself, right? And still, The Stranger has these very weird rhythms to it. And it's like, so even when he's trying to kind of like sell out, he can't really do it. He just doesn't have it in him to make a straight ahead movie. He just doesn't. This is what it's going to be.
It's one of those movies, really. I mean, if people have a way to do it, they should seek it out. That's a wonderful little movie.
By the way, it's out of copyright, so like you can find it anywhere, but try and find a decent looking version because there's versions out there that look like they've been shot to an ice cube because again, it's been out of copyright. I watched a couple of his other film noirs that I mentioned. I watched Scarlet Street, which is terrific. He's like the sort of henpecked guy, a little who this woman, Joan Bennett, I believe, thinks he's rich and starts kind of like conniving to get his money and by acting like she's interested in him, even though, of course, he's like a good 30 years older than her and stuff like that. And then the other film noir was The Red House. Have you ever seen that one?
No.
It's a weird one because it's a film noir that takes place out in the country. A very strange setting. There's this barn that Edward G. Robinson keeps telling his adopted daughter, "Don't go into the barn, see? Don't go into the barn," And you're like, "Well, of course I'm going to go right to the barn because you keep telling me not to go in the barn." I had heard that it was like a classic, and I watched it and I liked it, but I didn't love it. I thought it was like a little too drawn out, a little too long. I got a little like in the hour 40 mark, I kind of got like, all right, where is this going? But it's unusual. It's very, I mean, again, a film noir set out in the country, as opposed to the dark urban streets and stuff. But I mean, he was a perfect fit, right? He's a perfect fit for that genre. And not obviously, there's multiple reasons why this is sad that, for a guy so, and I mentioned in the intro, so openly anti-fascist and, tried to serve in two wars for Pete's sakes, and they couldn't, they wouldn't allow him to. And yet he gets under the thumb of HUAC, and it kind of ruins his career. Not ruins it, but it sidelines his career right at a point where film noir is becoming one of the big preeminent genres. And you're like, he could have been in 10 other classic film noirs from major studios had he not had to kind of be out in the wilderness a little bit because he's got the perfect persona for that genre.
Yeah, he really does. He really does. A movie I just saw last week, I think. You mentioned it when you reminded me when you mentioned a henpecked husband. He's not a henpecked husband in this one, but have you seen The Woman in the Window?
I saw that is like the, he did. That's another one with Joan Bennett. They did two to get him and Dan Duryea. They did two of them together. I have seen that. I didn't see it recently for the prep of this episode, but I have seen that one.
And Joan Bennett, Raymond Massey, is directed by Fritz Lang. It has kind of this weird little whole Twilight Zone-y ending. But the movie itself is interesting because, again, and the thing is, I hate to even say that it's Robinson playing against type, because really, when you start watching more of his movies, you realize he had a lot of different types. And he's a professor in this one who gets caught up in a crime noir kind of situation, and but it's very interesting to see him play a smart man who is out of his depth in a sense. And yeah, and that's one of the things that I've really enjoyed about kind of going through his filmography is seeing all the kinds of different roles that he actually took on. And you had mentioned before that he tested for Planet of the Apes, which would have been amazing. And then he did Soylent Green, and it makes me wonder if given it, if he hadn't died of bladder cancer, if it would science fiction have been something that he would have been found another path in his career for.
Edward G. Robinson as Obi-Wan
You know,
Kenobi.
I would not be surprised to see him in Star Wars somewhere,
That's a name
but
I haven't heard for a long time. A long time. Absolutely
yeah,
amazing. That's a, oh man, I'm living that alternate universe, right? Where he's got a lightsaber and he's running around. What the hell am I doing here? And again, my imitation is just the Bugs Bunny imitation, of course. So I did watch a couple of his kind of like lower budget, the ones that he was forced to do after his career got dinged, thanks to he was gray listed. And he's actually I can't necessarily speak for the veracity of this movie, so I don't want to necessarily drag it too far into this discussion of what the real man did, but he is a character in the movie Trumbo that they made about 5 years ago with Bryan Cranston as Dalton Trumbo, talking about his career, because Mikkel Stuhlbarg plays Edward G. Robinson, and Edward G. Robinson did apparently give some testimony to HUAC, and he was some of his friends did not obviously were not happy with him about that. And there's a line in the movie that when Edward G. Robinson says, again, I can't, don't know if this is just he really said this or this is just a line for dramatic purposes, but he sort of says to Trumbo, well, Dalton, you can just write under another name and still have a career. All I have is my face, and everyone knows my face. And if I lose this, I lose everything. And again, the movie isn't necessarily saying that was the right decision or whatever. I'm just saying that if you're interested in Edward G. Robinson and maybe seeing that slice of it, you could watch that movie. I thought it was a fairly decent movie. And again, how many movies have Edward G. Robinson as a character? But I watched one called Illegal. And these movies are all like 79 minutes, right? They're very simple. He's generally the only star. Right, he's top billed, and it's filled with a cast that like mostly you've never heard of. It looks cheaper, they look cheaper. You can find them on streaming on like six different channels because it's like who even owns them anymore. Illegal wasn't bad. He plays a lawyer who accidentally sends a guy to the electric chair who turns out to be innocent, and then so that's actually pretty good. I thought that was pretty well done. And then I watch another one called Nightmare, which is with Kevin McCarthy from Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That one I didn't like as much. That was kind of a for a movie about a guy suffering from nightmares and did he commit a murder? Did he not commit a murder? I thought that one was a little bit of a snooze fest. But he did like if you look through his filmography on IMDb, you'll see in like from like 48 to like 54, he's got like 10 movies that I think the even if you're like a diehard fan, you're like, what are those? Right, and they have very generic titles, like I said, like Illegal, Nightmare, like they're both, like what even is
Movie.
that? Yeah, exactly. It's like the terrible SEO for these movies. But nevertheless, I'm glad that he kept working. And as I mentioned in the intro, then Cecil B. DeMille luckily was like, oh, screw that, I don't care, I'm hiring you to be in the Ten Commandments. And even though that movie is, it's got its flaws, it's.
Right.
I was happy, I'm like, I like the guy and I'm happy to see him in such a massive production. And obviously, he became quite good friends with Charlton Heston because, again, they would continue to work together. So I did see a couple of those. So what's another one of those of his that you've seen? Maybe I have not seen.
I think you kind of went through a bunch of the ones that
Okay.
I have seen already.
Okay.
There's, gosh, what is the name of that one? Well, of course, House of Strangers is really good.
Oh, I haven't seen that one. What's that one?
House of Strangers?
Yeah.
That one is, and actually, I think people have, I've seen some people saying that that is something that he might have been, because he never won an Oscar.
Not even
He,
nominated.
no,
Not
not
even.
even
That was, I
nominated.
couldn't believe when I looked that up. I'm like, that can't possibly be true. And I'm like,
Yeah.
yeah, it was never even nominated. That's nuts.
And he did end up receiving a lifetime
Yes.
award, but of course it was posthumous.
Yep.
House of Strangers, if I'm remembering this right, is a movie that people thought that he should have been nominated for.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's very much I believe, I'm sorry, I'm doing this off the top of my head from memory.
Is it like a thriller? Is it like a
Yes, it is
noir
a
type thing?
thriller.
Okay.
It has to do with family, with a lawyer. It has to do with a man who gets out of prison, a love affair, and betrayal within the family, it's a thriller in the sense that it there's a lot there's a lot of people making bad decisions
Okay.
that everyone is that the that is going to have an effect on everyone else around them, and you kind of just see these mistakes snowballing, along with everything else that's happening, and it has this kind of inevitability to it, because, like I said, there's it's not, I don't want to call it a bank job, but there's basically funny things happening at the bank that they're a part of, and it all just kind of catches up to everybody.
Gotcha.
Again, this is Edward G. Robinson's leading this movie, and Susan Hayward is in it, and Richard
Oh,
Conte.
Susan Hayward's in. Okay, so it was some other stars then. Okay.
And so it wasn't, I don't think it was necessarily one of those years out in the wilderness movies, but I think it's a movie that gets overlooked a lot.
It's 1949, so it's right. It's kind of just as that's about to happen to him. That right? Because if I'm looking at the titles after he does House of Strangers, because he's Richard, Susan Hayward, Richard Conte, who I love from The Godfather, he's great, and Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., Alfred the Butler from Batman the Animated Series. And you look at the movies he does after this, right? Operation X, Actors in Sin, Vice Squad, Big Leaguer, The Glass Web, Black Tuesday. For the Defense, The Violent Men, Tight Spot, Illegal, Hell on Frisco Bay, Nightmare, right? It's like, wow, that is just kind of one movie after the next where you're like, who, what? What movie is that? Now, some of these do have other stars in it, like Violent Men has Glenn Ford and Barbara Stanwyck, and then he does Ten Commandments, but it's like, yeah, that's a lot of movies that are kind of like are like, what movie is that? You know what I mean? Like, what even is it?
Yeah, and I think it's kind of what you said. I think he, and this is going to sound so stupid to say about Edward G. Robinson, but you kind of see that he was at a point where his career really had a chance at breaking out in a lot of ways, at least getting away from the kinds of movies that he had been doing already. And then that just got really hamstrung by Hu'ok and all that, and this just and yeah, like you said, it's that was probably his last solid kind of movie for a while.
So yeah, there's a couple others I want to mention before we get to Soylent Green. I mentioned he's in A Hole in the Head, which is a Frank Capra movie with Frank Sinatra. He plays the husband to Thelma Ritter, my beloved Thelma Ritter. And I mean, could you imagine a more perfect couple, right? Edward G. Robinson and Thelma Ritter. And those are like, I wish those had been like my grandparents, right? Because they just probably were like, they imagined them together, just so fun. So he's in a movie. He's in a movie called Pepe. from 1960. Are you familiar at all with this movie, Max?
No,
Okay. All right.
I'm not.
Strap in, everybody, because I have to mention what Pepe is. So, have you seen Around the World in 80 Days, the
Yes.
1956 film? Okay. So, that movie stars David Niven and the Mexican comedian actor Cantinflas.
Cantinflas,
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know if we say it incorrectly.
No.
That movie is a massive hit. It makes a ton of money. Makes like in adjusted like 2025 dollars, it makes like $700 million. It's a gigantic hit. It wins Best Picture. Like it's a winner across the board. So Hollywood is like, well, this. I'm sorry. How do you say his name correct? I want to make sure I say it right.
Cantinflas. It's
Cantinflas. Okay,
Cantinflas, yeah.
Cantinflas.
You.
Hollywood is like, well, he's going to be the next big thing because he is a huge. He's the Charlie Chaplin of Latin America,
Yeah,
and a
he's a huge star
huge
in
star
yeah.
and like a cultural figure, not just even like a movie star, but like was kind of like an avatar for the underclass kind of, and like he spoke out. So he was a huge cultural figure in other parts of the world. And so here he is in this movie, Around the World in 80 Days, and Hollywood is like, well, let's okay. So they give him his own movie called Pepe. The entire story of Pepe. I'm gonna try and go through this as fast as I can. The entire story of Pepe is he works as a hired hand on a ranch. And he's really close to the animals, especially this one horse. And then one day, a movie director played by Dan Daly shows up and says, "I need a horse for some movies." And he goes to the ranch owner and he buys the beloved horse, and he takes the horse. And then Pepe is horrified and he decides, "Well, I'm going to go to Hollywood and retrieve my horse." And on the way, he has many adventures. So if this sounds like it should be called Pepe's Big Adventure, right? I mean, I have no, I did, a, by the way, there is an article on this movie coming out on my Real Retro Cinema column for 13thdimension.com in December. The movie came out in December of 1960, so it's the 65th anniversary. So I did a lot of research on Pepe. And on the way, Pepe meets no less than 36 different movie stars,
Wow.
right? And the movie, it's a light comedy. Its original running time was over 3 hours.
Oh my God.
It
What?
is insane, right? That you would make a movie. Now, I gotta give it was Columbia Pictures. I gotta give Columbia Pictures credit for making a person of color the lead of their movie in 1960.
Yeah.
This is a couple of years, Sidney Poitier was up and coming at that point, but he was not Sidney Poitier yet. Imagine saying, "We're going to hang a 3-hour movie and we're going to lard it up." And I mean that in the best sense possible. We're going to lard it up in this movie, just off the top of my head. In this movie, Pepe meets Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Tony Curtis, Janet Leigh, Kim Novak, Ernie Kovacs, Bing Crosby, Maurice Chevalier,
Janet Lee, I see.
Janet Leigh. Yes, thank you, Janet Leigh. And he meets any there that's like 10, oh, and Jack Lemmon in drag in the costume he wore from Some Like It Hot, which means
Wow.
his appearance in Pepe is the only time that costume was seen in color,
Oh,
because
wow.
Some
Yeah.
Like It Hot is in black and white. It is a it I love big swings like that, right? I love when Hollywood just like says, "Let's try and do this." And unfortunately, it's a giant flop, and the movie's cut from like over 3 hours to like 2 hours and a half. There was an animated sequence apparently that got cut. Oh, Debbie Reynolds is in it, by the way. Debbie Reynolds. There's a fantasy sequence with Debbie
Wow.
Reynolds where she's miniaturized. It's a crazy movie. And
Oh,
It's a completely forgotten movie. It's never been on home video in any format. Some lunatic posted it on YouTube and I watched all 3 hours of it. But anyway, the reason I mentioned
Wait, 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 wait. So it ended up being 3 hours?
the roadshow version was like 3 hours and 10 minutes or something. And
Wow.
then they cut like a half hour out of it. And so the version that exists that you can watch on YouTube, some crazy person uploaded it in 5 minute chunks of 33 chunks. And you can
Holy
just watch it.
smoke.
And so the released version is, I think, 157 minutes.
Oh,
It's
wow.
nuts. It's you're like, why would you make a movie this long?
Yeah.
It's crazy. But Edward G. Robinson is in it, and he is actually not doing a cameo. He's actually playing a part. He is playing the studio owner, and he befriends Pepe and stuff like that. And so he's in it fairly significantly. And it's like, I'm
Wow.
just imagining, like, he just did a favor for Columbia Pictures at that point. But anyway, he is in Pepe. I can't recommend it as a movie to watch, but if you like old-time Hollywood spectacle, and unfortunately it ruined Cantinflas's Hollywood career. He went back to Latin America and continued on, had an amazing career and was a beloved figure and all the way until he died in like his 80s,
Right.
in the 90s. But that was it. Like he did those two movies. Like Pepe just killed the career, which is really unfortunate. But anyway, Edward G. Robinson is in Pepe. I just needed to mention that. I did a lot of
Wow.
research on Pepe. I felt like I had to mention
I'm gonna have to
it.
find this movie.
It is on YouTube. You can. I'll find you the link. I'll send it to you because it and the version that the person uploaded isn't high quality, so it doesn't look great. But nevertheless, it exists. So another movie he did, which I actually just mentioned last month on the show with Dr. Ange, where we talked about the Martin Scorsese personal journey through American movies documentary, is a movie called 2 Weeks in Another Town, where Edward G. Robinson plays a film director in Italy making a movie, and he kind of knows that his career is on the downslope, and he's still trying to pull out a winner, and he's dealing with how modern movies are made, and that he's dealing with money men. And there's this great scene where he's talking to this backer, and he's like, look, if you give me 2 more weeks and like an extra, $300,000, I can make you a much better movie. And the guy's like, no. And Edward G. Robinson's like, your name is going to be on this movie. Don't you care to have your name on something that's good? And the guy's like, no, I don't care. I just need this to make money. And it's an unofficial sequel to The Bad and the Beautiful, because I
Oh.
don't they're not playing Kirk Douglas is in both. He's not playing the same character from what I remember. But it's a and they're but they're both directed by Vincent Minnelli, and they're both about making movies. And Edward G. Robinson is terrific in that as a guy who knows his career is pretty much over. And but yet he can't quite accept that because it's like he burns to make movies. So he's really, really good in that. I mentioned Batman. And then the last movie that he did, the most recent one that he made before we get this on the green, he did a heist movie called The Biggest Bundle of Them All, with Raquel Welch. At the absolute peak of her unbelievable gorgeousness, and Robert Wagner, and he's the money man in this. And there's this amazing scene in The Biggest Bundle of Them All. He sits them all down, and he's like, "All right, see, this is the plan." And he literally has like 11 by 14 placards that he's made that describes the con. And it's like it's some weird version of the Subterranean Homesick video where it's like, okay, we're gonna rob a bank, and he has like a giant dollar sign, and then he moves to the next card, and he's like, okay, then we're gonna knock the cop out, see? And there's like a drawing of a guy getting hit in the head. It's like so funny. Like, who made this? You go to the Kinko's in Italy in 1968. Like, what is this? It's really funny. It's not a great movie. Robert Wagner is ostensibly the lead, and he's kind of like. Something like a dick through the movie, but Edward G. Robinson's in it and it's fun. And Raquel Welch is, like I said, just like ungod. Like who looks like this, right? Raquel Welch in 1968, and they put her in a bikini through
Oh,
the
of
whole movie
course.
because they knew, the poster is her in a bikini, whatever.
Well,
So okay, one,
you don't sell the steak, Rob.
yeah, exactly. So the one last thing I do want to mention before we get to Son of the Green is the Planet of the Apes test footage, because that does exist to watch. You can see it. He was going to play Dr. Zaius, and the makeup isn't very good. It's clearly like proto makeup, and obviously they were just doing a quick version to kind of just, sell the idea to 20th Century Fox. I'm like, well, this is kind of what it would look like, and it's the scene where they're talking about the doll and stuff like that, and. No slight to Maurice Evans, who was a fantastic actor and great as Dr. Zaius. It is a shame that that Edward G. Robinson wanted to do it, but he just couldn't because he knew the makeup would be so taxing to put on every day. Because it's like that would have been re like Zaius. I mean, Maurice Evans is like Zaius is tough. Obviously, he's the one who's like you may not like what you find, he's, but it would have been, he had kind of I don't know, he, whatever energy he brings to that role, Edward G. Robinson would have brought a very different energy. That would have been fascinating to see him in that part.
Yeah, it would have been a very different character. I mean, still, I think still effective, but it would have been a very different kind of character than the Zaius that everyone knows. It's because that version is kind of an intellectual, I guess, who thinks he knows better, and he's being it's very paternal. And I think Edward G. Robinson's would have been more, gosh, I don't know. I don't know how to say it, except, more Edward G. Robinson.
He w it would have been like more, yes, I think it would have been come across as less intellectual, probably more forceful, maybe, I don't know. It would have been interesting because I mean, he did play scientists in other movies and stuff like that, but so. Yeah, it would have been interesting. It would have been really interesting to see him in that part. But I could see if, if he's in his late, by that point, see, he's born in 1893. So this is like 67. I mean, good Lord, he was 75, like 75 years old. I see, well, who the hell wants to have this stuff put on? And, we have the benefit of hindsight of knowing, well, of course you want to be in a Planet of the Apes. It's going to be one of the great movies ever made. But, imagine growing up in Hollywood and being like, I worked with Humphrey Bogart and Bette Davis and Susan Hayward and all these people. And now you want me to put monkey makeup on?
You're
Really?
gonna hide me under all this makeup that I have to sit in a chair for, hours a day, and
You can sort of see it. So anyway, so
I'm just
okay.
here as a favor for Chuck,
Yeah, right. Exactly. And obviously they had struck up quite a great friendship because of course they do another movie together, Soylent Green. So let's finally talk about Soylent Green. It came out on April 19th, 1973. For anyone who hasn't seen it, I'm going to give the bare bones version of the plot. Not going to spoil anything in case you haven't seen it. In 2022, the devastating effects of overpopulation, global warming, and pollution have made Earth almost unlivable. New York City has now 40 million residents, and with extreme shortages of food, water, and housing, most people are reduced to eating highly processed food made by the Soylent Corporation. They've created Soylent Red, Soylent Yellow, and now they have a new product made from plankton, Soylent Green. NYPD Detective Robert Thorne, who lives in a cramped apartment with his friend and colleague Saul Roth, is investigating the murder of the wealthy William Simonson, a member of the board of Soylent. After some digging, it becomes clear that this was no random homicide. And even though he is told to close the case by his chief, Thorne keeps going. Roth consults some ancient records and learns the horrible truth. Roth is so shaken by what he learns that he decides to commit assisted suicide via a government facility. Thorne tries to stop him but arrives too late. As his final words, he tells Thorne the truth, which only spurs Thorne on to get to the bottom of the case. Charlton Heston plays Thorne, of course. Edward G. Robinson is Roth. The movie also features Lee Taylor Young as Sherl, Chuck Connors as Tab. I love these names for these characters. Brock Peters is Chief Hatcher. The great Joseph Cotton is Simonson. Mike Henry is Kulozic, and Paula Kelly is Martha. The movie was directed by Richard Fleischer and written by Stanley Greenberg, based on the book Make Room, Make Room by Harry Harrison. So now you have the book, right? And you've not read it, but you have it.
I do have it, yeah.
Okay. You've not read it yet, right?
I started reading it actually after we once we arranged to talk about this movie. I said, I gotta dig that out. And I took a picture and I sent it to you, and I have started reading it. Yeah, I have not. I'm not far into it, but I am reading it.
How is it so far?
It's very Harry Harrison. If anyone reads
I don't
science
know what that means.
fiction,
I've never read a Harry
yeah,
Harrison book, so I don't know what that means.
Harry Harrison actually, and you would think that he would be famous for this book, but he's actually had a series called The Stainless Steel Rat,
Oh,
and
that's him?
that's him. That's the same guy.
Oh, I didn't
Yeah,
know
see,
that. Okay,
exactly.
I've heard of
So
that. Yeah.
yeah, and see, and yeah, that's what he's famous for. That's what he's known for. And you know, he wrote this in 66, and you know, it was originally serialized in a magazine, and but yeah, so he it is the basis for the movie. It is, I think he is quoted as saying like maybe 50% of his book is
Yep.
actually on the screen.
Yeah.
He was not necessarily happy with a lot of the stuff that they changed because the big plot point about Soylent Green was added to the movie. The misogyny, the way that women are treated, was not in the book,
And there's no murder plot. Like
and there's no murder
the
plot. Exactly. And so a lot of it was different, but he apparently was happy that the message of the dangers of overpopulation, which is what the book is really about, made it into the movie.
Okay. So yeah, there's this whole I mentioned Lee Taylor Young and Paula Kelly are in Paula Kelly, I think from what I remember actually, she was the first DA on Night Court. That's
Was
where
that
I remember
her?
her from. That was her. I think she's in like the first season, and then they replaced her with I think it was Ellen Foley, and then like they replaced her with Markie Post, and then it was Markie Post was on the show for like the rest of the year. But Paula Kelly, to my memory, was the first like she was in like the first season of Night Court.
Oh,
And
wow.
the whole bit about that, yes, all women basically in this world are just they have no rights anymore, and they are quite literally furniture in that when like a rich guy only the rich can afford nice homes. Yeah, science fiction. And that when they buy an apartment, it comes with a woman. It
Right, and
like
furniture. It's
she's like
furnished, yeah.
furniture. And they are treated as basically prostitutes. And there's the movie spends actually quite a bit of time on that angle. And so I can imagine if you're Harry Harrison, you're kind of like, well, that's not in my book. And the movie is like spending many, many scenes. There's a scene where Chuck Heston goes and he visits like a bunch of the concubines as they're together, and like there's a whole thing. Like it spends a lot of time talking about that for something that they added to the book. And like I said, the murder plot is not in the book as well. So again, as you mentioned, he was not super happy with it. So Richard Fleischer, an interesting career because he directed some genuine classics. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, one of my favorite movies. The Charles Bronson movie, Mr. Majestic, which is a great movie. Fantastic Voyage, another classic movie. He did a movie with Orson Welles called Compulsion. I imagine directing Orson Welles, not easy. When you're not when he's not directing as well, that's a really good movie. But then unfortunately, he had a very rough 80s and he ended his career with nothing but stinkers like Amityville 3D, Conan the Destroyer, and Red Sonja. So it's a shame. A really, really solid career. I mean, Soylent Green is 73. I still think that was kind of, you could say that's a highlight of a career. And yet, by the 80s, it was like pretty rough stuff. But you know what? All of God's creatures deserve to be judged by their best work. And he made a lot of really terrific movies. So, overall, what did you think of Soylent Green? Like, I watched it many decades ago, and then I rewatched it for the purpose of this. So, I was sort of seeing it fresh. So, what was your, how do you feel about Soylent Green now?
You know, I did the same thing. It was a movie I had seen when I was very young. I was probably like maybe 13, 14, the first time I saw it, maybe. And then watched it again, and I had forgotten a lot of it. I of course everyone knows the big reveal. But I had forgotten a lot of the details about it. I promise I won't hammer on this too much, but with the way things are in society today, in the world we live in, it really kind of hits differently because you as you watch it, you kind of go like, oh yeah, well that makes sense. And yeah, of course that's happening. And it's I think it's a movie that has been reduced to that famous line, which of course it's a hell of a line, but I think it's kind of a shame because it really has a whole lot more to say than that. And because it's about poverty, it's about inequality, it's about corporations, it's about resources and the environment and really kind of just like life and death, and it's just and what and quality of life. And it's it is in a way, I think, and maybe Harry Harrison would be happy to hear this, but if you were still with us, it's about more than what the button on the movie is. And it's about where women are in society, and it's there's so much going on in this movie that I know myself personally, I watched it and I kind of wanted to immediately watch it again because I felt like there was probably a ton of stuff that I had missed the first time around. And there's is just really well acted. I'm obviously, we're talking about Edward G. Robinson too, but he's wonderful in this movie, and he is really kind of that again, the heart of this movie. I think Charlton Heston does a wonderful job. And matter of fact, this is probably some of my favorite acting of his. And it's just it has a lot to say, like a lot of science fiction that is hiding behind some tropes that you might be familiar with.
I'm well, agree to all I agree with all of that. I mean, yeah, Charlton Heston, right? For as much as he kind of had an unfortunate last couple of years in terms of like his sort of public persona, because he was, well, we're not going to get into it, but I mean, talk about it, like king of the sci-fi, right? I mean, Planet of the Apes, the Omega Man, and Soylent Green, like that's great. I mean, you could see a lot of other actors of his stature kind of being like maybe, turning up their nose at sci-fi because it looked, sci-fi was still considered, 2001, A Space Odyssey notwithstanding, kind of considered a ghetto genre, and here he is, lending his star power to three different movies that go on to be very famous, one of them way more than the rest of them, but obviously, like, that's pretty remarkable stuff.
And classics of the genre. I mean,
Yeah, I
like
mean,
just.
three classics of the he's the lead in three classics of the genre within 5 years. Because you've
Yeah, it's
got
amazing.
68 Planet of the Apes and Omega Man is 71, and then Soylent Green is 73. That's amazing. The thing I picked up on watching it this time and again, and maybe I picked up on it when I watched it in my video store days, and I just forgot. It's been, I'm so old now that I've watched movies and I'm like, I don't remember anything from it. But obviously, everybody knows the Soylent Green is people. Like that's just part of the culture at this point, and the movie is so famous for that. Part of it is that it is literally the last line of the film. It is he's that's the last thing he says, and then bang, we get credits. Is the flaw of the movie, I would say. And by the way, I don't think I've mentioned the screenwriter, Stanley Greenberg. Only had a couple other credits. Famously, he wrote the TV movie The Missiles of October about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and actually, he wrote the Charlton Heston film Skyjacked, which is a great, which sounds fun. I've never seen Skyjacked, but you have to and you got to say it like that. But the flaw, I'd say, of Soylent Green is the Soylent Green as a concept doesn't really figure into the movie that much. right? It's
No.
it, the they it's not it's introduced as like, oh, well, you've all been eating Soylent Red, you've all been eating Soylent Yellow, here's Soylent Green, it's even better. And it's kind of like not mentioned again through most of the movie, and then it comes back in at the end. And so when you get the big reveal, I don't think it lands all that much, because you're like, well, the movie hasn't really built to it. It's not like Planet of the Apes, where the whole thrust of that movie is Taylor trying to figure out how did this planet he landed on, how did it get to be so like Earth, and yet it isn't. And then it leads to, of course, maybe the greatest ending in the history of movies or
Right.
something. But it's the whole movie is building, building, building to this reveal, and then the reveal is better than even what you imagined. So the Green is kind of like this police procedural, which, as we mentioned, is added to the movie. It's not in the book. And so the Green is just kind of peripheral to it. So when it comes back in at the end, you're like, oh, well, all right. Like, okay. Like,
Right.
yeah, that's shocking. But like, you don't get the sense that you don't get the sense that anyone's going to learn that some of the greenest people, you know what I mean? Like, you just said it's all going to get covered up, and okay. So it doesn't land. But then, in a weird way, kind of going back to what you were saying, well, then that is like, well, the movie isn't really about Soylent Green then. It's about other stuff, and how good is it on that stuff? And on that stuff, I think it's really good, right? But it is kind of like, it's almost like it became too iconic for its own good. Kind of, you know what I mean? Because you're like, so the greenest people. All right, credits. All right.
Literally.
You know, go back
No,
out
and
into the 70s, everybody. You know what I mean? So.
And I mean, it is kind of threaded through the movie, because you see, like you're saying, oh, Tuesday is Soylent Green Day because it's the
Right.
new stuff, and there's a scene where Roth, Robinson's character, is telling Thorne. He's telling Thorne, because they live together,
You're right.
they work together, and they live together. Is telling him, pick up some soil. What happened to the soil in green? Oh, I ate it. I was hungry. And then later, right before the really nuts riot scene,
With the scoopers, they're literally
by the
scooping people
scoopers,
up.
my
Yeah.
God. And there's someone selling Soylent crumbs,
Right, broken
and
pieces of Soylent in a bag, right? Like loose pieces, yeah.
exactly. And and then the books that are found in the murder victim's apartment. And so there's little reminders here and there, but I would say what, like 80% of the movie is a cop movie. It's Thorne trying to solve a case that has nothing to do with Soylent Green. It has
Right.
nothing to do with that at all, except that the guy who was killed was on the board of directors.
Right. And he learned that Soylent Green was made from people, and he was horrified by that, and he was killed to be kept quiet. That's the whole
Right.
gist of it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, he was the guy from the board of directors is killed
Joseph Cotton.
because he like you said, he's horrified by what they're doing. That Soylent Green is being processed from dead people, basically. And I guess the rest of the board decides that he's a liability now, and they have him killed, and that's what sets everything into motion. But of course, you don't know that until right at the end of the movie, and so you kind of it's just kind of this police procedural, like you said, that is really more about why there's even a need for something like Soylent Green in the first place. And so, like you said, I mean, the line is iconic, but that's actually not, that's kind of what the movie's about, but not really. It's a result of what the movie is about.
Yes, exactly. Yes, that's a great way of putting it. The movie is about all these other ideas of what life would be like if we don't get some of these things under control. And the Soylent Green is the result of that. But yeah, it isn't. It's and so all the, like I said, all the other stuff is good. Like Edward G. We should talk about Edward G. Robinson. He is, first of all, I love the dynamic him and Heston have together
It's
because
so natural.
it's very sweet. And
Yeah.
I could see Charlton Heston, who we know was like a man's man, right? Like I could see him. I could see some actors of that era not being comfortable playing that level of vulnerable. Like they tell each other that they love each other. And they're not related. They're not father and son, you know, they're not uncle and nephew. They're just colleagues. And it's Roth who remembers the old times. He's the guy who's, and like they have this great scene where they eat a salad. They've managed to get some actual lettuce. And of course, Heston, who's just never known anything but this world, is like, what the? Like his taste buds can't handle fresh vegetables. You know,
But
he's
well,
like, what is
he steals it from the murder victim's apartment.
that's right. That's right. That's right. And Roth is like, ah, oh, this is great. You know, and I'm like, what? But like, it's a very sweet relationship. And I have to think that was a result of their relationship, that of Charlton Heston's relationship with Edward G. Robinson. Like, they clearly had a great friendship over the decades, because you're talking about they worked together in Ten Commandments, and this is almost 20 years later. And so all that stuff with Raw, I love his beret, by the way. I love, look at the beret that he wears.
And his goatee and
His goatee, look, he looks like, it's like Van Gogh, right, or something. And
yeah.
so he, and you know, he looks terrible. But again, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I think everybody looks terrible in this movie. This is a very sweaty movie.
Yeah, I
You
have that in
know,
my notes too.
it's very sweaty. They should have mentioned it in that first episode of Cheers, where they have their runner about the sweatiest movie of all time, and Sumner's like, "Cool hand, Luke." I'm like, somebody should have said Soylent Green, because obviously there's no air conditioning, and the world's been overheated, and so everyone and the apartment they live in is real cramped. But they have a great dynamic, and all that stuff is terrific. And I liked all the stuff about the concubines. I loved that whole notion of like that's what women in this world have been reduced to, and that's what poor people have been reduced to. Like they have, the poor people in this movie have no dignity. They're just these starving mobs. But it's like, but that's how the ruling class does it, right? It's like they want to think that they are better than these people, so they deprive these people of everything, which of course makes people become more feral because they're struggling to just survive. And that allows the aristocracy to say, well, see, these people were animals. We were right all along. It's like, well, yeah, but you've been starving them to this point. Of course they act like this. So all that stuff is really good. So it's a weird thing where it's like the movie is better than the iconic line that it's the only reason most people know it anymore.
And it's it like I said, it has a lot to say, and but what it really has to say is about what it's really talking about is inequity. Because you see that, like I mentioned, Thorne steals he actually steals quite a bit of things from the murder victim's apartment. He steals food. He steals a piece of beef, which is like unheard of. It was even difficult for the rich person to get a hold of. He steals soap. He steals a bar of soap. And a bottle of bourbon. And in the scene that you're talking about, Roth makes a meal for them, and it actually just occurred to me, Roth probably had to make it because Thorne probably doesn't know how to cook.
Yeah, right. Why would he? If you're just
Why
eating
would
these
he? He's
little tablets, yeah.
But something that is threaded through this entire movie is this kind of casual corruption, at all levels. Thorne is stealing from a murder victim. He has to give his police captain, Hatcher, a cut. There's the just at every point, people are okay. So there is this corruption that is almost like a sense coming out of a sense of hopelessness. It's like a fatalism that just pervades everything.
Wonder what that's like.
And yeah, I know. I wonder. And it's frightening in the sense that that corruption doesn't matter because nothing matters at this point. You know, everyone is just trying to find a tiny piece of comfort, a tiny sense of security. And again, I wonder what that's like. And they have to find something to sustain themselves wherever they can find it. And everyone is working under this system. And so no, one thing that I thought was interesting was that like no one gets mad about it. It is just so expected that no one even blinks when this is going on. And you know, and I think that is just such an interesting thing to talk about. You know, there's just this bland, faceless evil of corporations and what they are doing to society. And you were mentioning, you know, how you know, with the furnitures, what they call the women who are basically concubines who come with the they're part of the lease, essentially. And you know, one of the questions I was thinking was like, is that better or worse for women in the society? You know, is it better for a woman to be furniture or to have her freedom and starve on the street, which literally happens at one point. At one point, you know, Thorne is going into a church looking for somebody, and there's a woman dead on the street with her child next to her. And he just kind of scoops up the kid, takes him into the church, and hands him off to someone else. You know, because this just, you get the sense that this is happening all the time. And, you know, it's, you know, with the concubines, with the furniture, you know, they are living in comfort. They have access to food. It, you know, their safety kind of depends on who they quote unquote belong to at that time. But in a way, you know, everyone is in some sort of trap, you know, because the women who are furniture are stuck in that part of the system. The people who are living on the street, you know, who are ostensibly free, at one point he tell Thorne tells Cheryl, because Cheryl says we can leave, and he's like, go where? Every city is like this, and you can't go to a farm, you can't go to the country because those are heavily guarded. You know, so they're in a sense they're trapped in these cities, and you know, and it's cramped, it's sweaty, it's claustrophobic, and there's this pervading sense of desperation that is so ingrained that it's normal.
Yeah, even when Brock Peters is his chief, the great Brock Peters from To Kill a Mockingbird and Admiral Cartwright in the Star Trek movies,
And he's wonderful in this movie.
when he tells Thorne, like, drop the case, there's not even like, now of course Charlton Heston was great as like the lone man, right? He was, I mean, literally the Omega Man. He's the lone man, but he was always, and he's the lone man in Planet of the Apes as well. But he was great as like the guy that everyone is telling don't do the thing, and he's like, I'm gonna do it, because that's just what his persona was. But it's like when his chief tells him drop the case because you're basically the higher ups don't want it, there's not even like, he doesn't even make an excuse. There's not even like a pretend there's a
No.
re oh we there's more important cases for you to follow up. It literally is just, look, you know how corrupt this is, don't do it. And there's just kind of like a shruggy, what are you gonna do? Right?
Yeah,
That
it's.
and then that kind of hopelessness of like, come on, man. This is, you know the drill.
Yeah,
And
it's
it's
basically,
like,
you know that
wow.
someone with more power than you or I is saying to stop. Yeah. And actually, that was a question I was going to ask you. Why do you think Thorne is so invested in solving the case? Because there's really no benefit to him doing it.
No. I think that's where you're leaning on Charlton Heston as an icon. Because I think, like I just said, I think Heston is always playing a guy who is, you know, I mean, he was, you know, for as much as he became kind of an icon of like conservatism and like, you know, the kind of opposite of what he espoused when he was younger, his persona was this kind of, I mean, contrary to playing Moses in the Ten Commandments, although that's that in its own way is that kind of part. he had that persona of like the individual, right? The guy who is going wants to do the thing, and he's going to do it regardless of what society tells him to do. And if anything, he almost is going to be knee jerk and like, you tell me not to do it. Well, now I want to do it more. And I think that's the shorthand of it, is that it's like, I there's something fishy here. And plus, kind of like, what else is there to do? Right? In a weird, like, there's the, you don't get the sense there's any entertainment. I mean, that's gone, right? There's
No
no
kind of culture at all,
there's no
yeah.
culture, right? That's a better term for it. There's no culture anymore. It's just survival. And I could see it's almost like, well, if that was what you were raised was to be a, not raised, but if that you were trained to be a cop, that's your muscle memory. And you're just going to go do it, you know? They don't, you could argue that that's a weakness of the film, right? That it doesn't layer that in. But it's, I don't know. I feel like he's kind of, he's an old world guy, even though he doesn't remember the world the way it was, the way Roth does. He's an old world guy, and he just has these values that he's still trying to cling on to, even though the world around him is absolutely crumbling. By the way, as a sort of a meta thing, this film was the last film shot on the MGM backlot, because
Right.
after this, they sold it to real estate developers. And for years, MGM, as it was a dying studio, let it get decrepit. They stopped repairing the facades, and they let trash accumulate. So it actually lent credence to the films. You get some verisimilitude in there, is that the, you know, this New York of what is it, 2022, I think, is when it
Right.
takes
Yes,
place.
yeah, it's supposed to be
Yikes.
2022.
The New York of 2022 looks like this, and it's like, well, that's, you know, and if you, again, if you want to do meta, you could say, well, this is MGM holding on with these lots to like a dying world. A dying world that Edward G. Robinson sure as shit remembered, right? Because he came up in it. And just as a my own personal thing, like, I have such an affinity for the notion of like the backlot. I that is just something like my wife likes to say that I've lived many lives, and I've always said to her, if I was ever, if I'd been reincarnated, I damn well better have worked at movie studios in the 30s and 40s. I'll be very upset if I find out that my previous life was not that. But like, I just love the notions of movie, of that. I've been to a couple of lots, and they were just like so, I was so amazed at the history that I was walking among these sound stages. It was amazing. And you know, it's kind of funny. You got to wonder, Edward G. Robinson must have been like, God, I remember the good old days, right? When these lots were, especially MGM, which was like the biggest of the big, and now he's, now they're doing this, you know? I mean, not that like it's a bad movie, but just watching it fall apart, watching MGM just be like, yeah, who kind of gives a shit? We're gonna sell it anyway. Like, that's a fatalism that I think adds to the movie in a way they probably didn't expect.
To the point that when they shot it, because normally they would shoot at angles where you don't see that, you don't see behind the facades. But for this movie, they didn't do that because it just, like you said, it just lent to the feeling of something that was falling apart. And and it's very effective. There are scenes where you can kind of see, like, oh, they probably did, Singing in the Rain on that street, or something. And it looks like a backlot, it looks like a set, but it works because it kind of enhances that sense of claustrophobia of how things are hemmed in. And because I think in the beginning it says what the population of New York is 40 million,
40 million, right?
and half of those people are unemployed. And don't worry, everybody, the actual population is like, I think, 8 million right now.
Yeah, we're
And
nowhere near that.
nowhere near that. And but yeah, it just it really, this movie has a look to it. And it's not just that 70s look, that early 70s look. It has it's a hot box. Everyone, like you said before, everyone looks sweaty, everyone looks tired. there are you know, every time Thorne leaves the building, he has to basically hop over people who are like 10 deep on his staircase, because they have nowhere else to be. You know, they have nowhere to sleep. You know, and it's just, for some reason, and you know, that could have backfired. You know, that could have taken away from, I think, the realism that this movie kind of needs, but it adds to it instead.
I agree. Robinson was, ill. He knew he was ill. I think he finally revealed it to Charlton Heston and then the crew and the director. And he apparently had a tough time remembering some of the scenes, and they had to make some adjustments to get him to be able to finish. And Heston apparently really took quite great care of him. Like really made sure he was comfortable and whatever, and just really doted on him, which is very sweet. Again, it's, I'm always sort of touched by that, of like kind of these guys that are like, Heston's like, I, like Edward G. Robinson's like, I've been there, right? And Heston's the kind of the newer version of that. And rare for, this show where we talk about someone's final film is that Edward G. Robinson, his literal final scene shooting in a movie is a death scene. Because as I mentioned in the synopsis, Roth goes and he consults these old journals. By the way, they stopped keeping records. Again, sounds a little too close to home. But they stopped keeping records, so he's consulting these older ones, and he finds out that the plankton can't possibly be made into Soylent Green because there's not enough plankton and yada yada yada, and he
The
just
oceans are dying.
the oceans are dying, and Roth just decides, you know what, I don't want to live on this planet anymore, and they have these assisted suicide places in the city, and he goes and he subjects himself to this sort of they put you in this bed and they show you these films of something kind of anything you want. By the way, the one of the clerks is Dick Van Patten. A young I don't want to say young Dick Van Patten, because Dick Van Patten looked old no matter like what
Is it?
age he
I
was,
was
but
going to
it's
say, is there such a thing as
yeah,
a
no,
young
I think he was
Dick
born looking like a dad, but it was a pre-eight is enough Dick Van Patten. And Roth gets to see footage of what the earth was like in the better days. And we see a sunset and we see some like great art and some of the great buildings. And it's
And
all
it's all done to
reflected on
classical
his
music.
And it's all reflected on his face in this kind of phantasmic oracle sort of way. And he's sort of reduced to tears at the sheer beauty of it as he slowly fades away. And it's a beautiful scene. And I'm impressed that a movie that's not that long, Soylent Green isn't even 2 hours, it's like 1 hour and 45, devotes, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 minutes to this scene. And it's literally the last thing Edward G. Robinson ever got to play. So his and then he died, I think, less than 2 months after he finished the movie. So
Well, I think he actually, what I read was that he actually died the day after he shot that.
was it that soon? I didn't realize it was that soon. Oh
I
my
think
goodness.
so. Yeah. No, well,
Wow. So
I think the movie was released a couple of months
oh, maybe that's what I'm
after
maybe
that.
that's maybe that's what I'm thinking of. But I mean, that's I can't imagine what's going through your head knowing that you're deathly ill and playing that. I can't imagine the emotion you're trying to bring to it and not make it mawkish. And it's really beautiful. And I love that, Thorne tries to stop him, but he's too late. I think they give him like a chemical. It's like a, like a some sort of,
Some sort of
drug,
cocktail,
some sort of cocktail. And he slowly fades off, and he does get to speak to Thorne, and he tells Thorne the truth, and that's what's it sort of inspires the final act of the movie. But it's a really beautiful death scene, and I'm sure I know I was watching it with a focus on Edward G. Robinson because we were doing this, but it was like, wow, this was, and again, in a meta sense, it's like this is the end of a brilliant career. This is the last you people are ever going to get to see this great actor, and we're going to give him something nice and big to do, and it's really. It's very sad, but it's beautiful in its own way.
Well, and he, I mean, it is one of the cornerstone scenes of this movie. I mean, it is, maybe the scene that sticks with me the most. But another great scene with him and Heston, and you see that chemistry also is the meal scene where they're eating the food that Thorne has stolen and brought back home. And he brings it. It's interesting because he never says it, but it becomes obvious that he stole that for Roth. You know, he didn't necessarily steal it for himself. He stole it because he wanted to bring Roth a gift. And so, you know, Roth prepares these things, you know, and it's a little salad and a little stew, it looks like. And it's a wordless scene. They don't speak. They're just kind of going, and laughing. You know, they're kind of giggling and ha ha ha-ing at each other. And that scene was actually improvised. You know, they just let them go on that scene. And the choices that they made, first of all, not to have any real dialogue, and but also how kind of pure it is, in the sense that these are two people enjoying something together, I think really kind of lays the groundwork for that death scene later. You know, you really see their friendship in that scene, because there's an intimacy in it.
It's what we said. They're very openly affectionate with one another, which is nice to see, right? It's very warm, and it's for Edward G. Robinson to be wrapping up a career of dozens and dozens of, I think it was probably over 100 credits, I think, when I saw, to kind of go out on something where you're really getting to chew on it, you real, no pun intended, you're getting a lot to do, that was totally not on purpose. You know what I mean? Like it's I again, I can only surmise what it would, what I can only guess what it would be like to know that you've been doing this thing for 60 years and this is it. This is it. But to know you've got a lot to do. And you're significant to the plot, you're significant to the sort of tone of the piece, and you get this really nice scene again where the movie stops for 5 to 6 minutes and just devotes itself to you. That's and it's you know it's the it's a nice capstone to a career. It really is. And so, yeah, I don't think Soylent Green is as good as it could be, but it's got a lot going on. It's got a lot on its mind. And like, that's like, if anything, I enjoy a movie that's maybe overstuffed with ideas rather than a movie that has nothing on its mind. That's worse, right? We see a movie and you're like, what was that? You know what I mean? It's like, I'd rather have a movie that has so much in it that you walk out going, boy, that threw a lot at me. Maybe all of it didn't quite land, but at least, okay. It had this and had this and had this kind of thing. I should mention that there is a reference in terms of, it's amazing how much Soylent Green as people has just completely bled into the culture. But like in Logan's Run, which came out in 75, when Michael York, not Jan Michael,
Michael
Michael
York,
York and the lovely Jenny Agutter run into that robot creature, and he talks about, there's an offhand line that he has that some of the food is ground up from people. And it's just a little aside. And I wonder, I'm like, look, obviously Harry Harrison was the first person to come up with this as a notion. But I have to think Soylent Green put it into the culture that much that that might have been a little nod, right, to that of like, oh yeah, that's what they're going to do in the future. But I would think as a way to end a career, certainly an unusual thing, considering R.G. Robinson had never really been in any sort of genre movie, and yet he ends up like on a nice big one that was a major, it was a hit, it was and pop culturally it really lasted on. So like, good for you, R.G. Robinson, you went out on a really good one.
Yeah, he really did. You know, and there's, you know, I don't know. It's a, like I said, when I saw it, I kind of wanted to watch it again, because I feel like there's probably a lot of little things that I missed the first time around. But you know, like one of the things that I love is that whenever there's a crowd shot outside, everyone's kind of covered in this green haze, and you know, and obviously it's supposed to be pollution. It's supposed to be smog, and because you see people with face masks and but there's just kind of this green haze over everything. And I can't help but wonder, was that a hint? Are all these people covered? Because the crowd scenes are crazy. They're thick with people. But it makes me wonder, is that a hint about Soylent Green? That the green is on top of these people because of Soylent Green's people. I just like, what we have talked about, when we've done a couple of for Film and Water, we've talked about, B movies
Yeah, we did a lot, right, a lot of grindhouse type
Yeah,
of
a lot of
Alucarda,
grindhouse.
our beloved Alucarda.
Yes, Alucarda. And we talked about the things that kind of like squick us out, and I think you had mentioned that it was cults for you.
I love cult movies.
Yeah, and for me, it's cannibalism. Cannibalism always makes me kind of go like, ugh. But I think in this one, it's more. I mean, it's obviously, yes, Soylent Green is people. There is cannibalism going. There is real cannibalism going on, but it's like this weird corporate process cannibalism, and
They're literally on an assembly line. We see Chuck
yeah, it's.
Heston fall into an assembly line, and it's the little green
Yeah,
squares, you know.
little green squares, which in itself is interesting, but it makes me wonder if that's just kind of and not to get too high-minded about a 1970s genre movie, but it makes me wonder if this is like a metaphor for the way a society consumes, the way it consumes its resources and the way it eventually consumes itself. And like I said, I think this movie, and maybe I am reading too much into it, I don't know, but I do think that this movie is saying more than is necessarily on the surface. Again, I think kind of what helps sell big ideas is the actors. I mean, Charlton Heston does a wonderful job. Everyone else around it is, because it's not a especially large cast, and Edward G. Robinson is just wonderful. And like you said, if he had to have a final movie, and I guess in a way we all do, this is, a hell of a way to go out.
Agree. Right. I remember when looking him up, like first, when I would start up and kind of like prepping the show and looking up certain actors, and I was like, oh, Soylent Green is his last movie, really? Like, because he's such a era, he's such an a piece of an earlier era, right? And I don't think I even knew that he lasted that long into the 70s, and he was still active. And then I was like, wow, he's in Soylent Green? Really? Like, you know what I mean? I didn't know any of that. That would have been back in my video store days when I was looking up people's careers in the back of those Leonard Maltin books. And I was like, oh, really? Since I didn't know that. This is really cool. So, yeah, there's a lot of great stuff Edward G. Robinson did. We do have to mention, and you pointed this out, Max, thanks so much, is that if you go to his IMDb page, he does have one more credit after Soylent Green, and that is a TV movie, which again, we don't talk about TV movies here because they are a different animal. No pun, again, no pun intended. I'm totally not meaning to do this. What am I, Dr. Ange? It is, it's a TV movie called Mooch, which is about a wily dog that has adventures. And I'm guessing if they figured Benji was a hit, we can do Mooch. It stars Vincent Price, who, as long as the check cashed, it was okay. And apparently, Ever G. Robinson is uncredited in a party scene. Now, I did not have a chance to watch Mooch in time for this. It's on YouTube. I was not going to subject myself. Look, I had other things to do, I have to say, before I was going to sit and watch. I had to watch 3 hours of Pepe. I didn't have time to watch Mooch. But I'm happy to know that in terms of the sort of like anal retentive nature of me in this show, it is not, it, yes, it was released after Soylent Green, but he did it long before he did Soylent Green. Because as you pointed out, Edward G. Robinson died very soon after filming his scenes for Soylent Green. So obviously Mooch was shot a year or two earlier, and then it just didn't make it on the television until 1974. But when we first talked about this, and you mentioned, you're like, well, actually, Mooch. I'm like, what? Like, what? And I had to go look it up. Like, he's in a TV movie called Mooch? What the hell is that about?
It's yeah, no, it's
Soylent
like you
Green.
said, luckily it's a TV movie. It's just a quick cameo. It's not a real role. And I don't think anyone needs to be remembered for
No,
Mooch.
Soylent Green. Soylent Green is the one you want to go out on. So,
Yes.
well, okay. As we're wrapping up here, Max, I have to ask you our exit question before we wrap up the show. And we kind of hinted at this, at least the subject earlier, in that it is incredible to know that Edward G. Robinson not only never won an Oscar, he was never even nominated. That just seems impossible considering how many movies he was in, how many big movies he was in, and how great he was in so many of those movies that
Right.
never once did he even get nominated. That had to hurt a little bit, right? Because you're like, what the hell? So we can't possibly kind of surmise what one he would have won for because, well, that's a whole other thing, who would have been the competition. But the question for you is, what performance of his would you think he should have at least been nominated for?
This is, a peak behind the curtain. You had let me know that this is going to be big, and it is such a hard question for me. It's I my immediate answer would have been Key Largo, just because Johnny Rocco is like the culmination of all of his gangster pictures. It's kind of all those characters coming fully formed in that movie. And it's just a great movie. I mean, he should have, in a movie full of, heavy hitters, he should have at least gotten a supporting actor nomination. The Stranger is a favorite of mine. And this is going to seem like a cop out. And I understand how this sounds, but I really think he should have been nominated for Soylent Green.
Okay.
I think, just based on the death scene alone, he is just so good in this movie, and he just and maybe some of it was the cancer, but he just does such a great job of seeming just tired but hopeful. He does not break until he finds out about Soylent Green.
Yeah.
He just keeps kind of plodding along. He's still working. He's still doing things. He complains about it all, but he keeps going until that moment. And his you can his good-heartedness in this movie comes through. He is, it's like we were saying, it's easy to kind of see him as a nah, guy. But his humanity comes through in this movie really well, and again that death scene, they call it going home. I'm going home. When he's watching the scenes of a sunset, of ocean waves, of deer in a field, and he start he his eyes just kind of well up with tears as he's watching this. And it's not because he's dying, it's because of what has been lost. And he is able to get that across wordlessly. And that to me is really impressive. And then as you've mentioned, Charlton Heston's character comes up and they talk very briefly. Before he dies, and he tells him, "I love you, Thorne." And I think because Charlton Heston does a great job in that scene also, because he is breaking, in that scene. And he says, "I love you too," or he says, "I love you Saul. I think he says, "I love you, Saul." Which is a big deal for two tough guy actors in an early 70s movie to do. And it is so heartfelt and it is so real. And I'm sure part of that is because, you know, they were real friends in life, and they were in a way they were saying goodbye to each other. But they channel that into these characters and into that scene in a way that I think was really deserving of that recognition.
Fair enough. I mean, they're all good choices. I mean, he should have been nominated multiple times, let alone,
Right.
at least once. But
What
yeah,
about you? What about you? What did
I think you make a good argument for Soylent Green, although I think the Hollywood was still not really nominating people from sci-fi, for the most part. And I'm still like, no. I actually really like him. And again, this is now the second episode where I've mentioned this very obscure movie. But I really liked him in 2 Weeks in Another Town. Again, I think there was no chance that was going to get. 'Cause it was not particular. It's not a particularly great movie, and I don't think it's even really very well known. And it's a follow-up to a much more popular movie. But I thought he was great in it because it's just a unique character, and he fills it with a lot of empathy of someone who has this passion to make this art, but unfortunately, the art he has chosen to make costs millions of dollars, and he's got to get somebody to give him the money to make the art. And he's now dealing with people that regard movies as just product. Again, wow, what a crazy future that portends. But and it's just he's great in it. Just a guy who knows his career is over, but what else is he going to do? Because he still burns to make it. So I think he's really good in that movie, and again, any of those you mentioned, though. Key Largo, I mean, Double Indemnity, for Pete's sakes. How did he not get nominated for that? So it's a complete, I mean, it's great that he got an honorary one and his family was there to receive it, and that's great. But nevertheless, good Lord, man, the guy was one of the great Hollywood figures, and he never get nominated once. That's shame on you, Academy. Just shame on you.
Yeah,
So,
60 years and not one nomination. It's like, and I think it is kind of what you say, you know, because they still don't really they don't give actor Oscars for sci-fi movies, and I don't think they gave them for gangster movies either. And unfortunately, I think that's kind of what he got pigeonholed into for a
could
while.
be. Yeah, right. Yeah. So he didn't do enough, kind of costume dramas and stuff like that. So, but yeah, it's a great career. There's a lot of great stuff to, I mean, we only scratched the surface. I mean, I watched like about a dozen movies in prep for this, and there was 2 dozen more that I could have gotten to. We just, I only have the time. But there's a lot of great stuff. And I would still, even though we've spoiled it all, if you haven't seen Soylent Green, still check it out because, again, anyone listening to you already know the gag, but the movie's got more to it than that, and it's worth checking out, everybody. So, well, Max, thank you so much for coming back to the show. Thank you so much for recommending this. This was just an absolutely great career to review. I feel like I know the guy more now than I did before, having even though I didn't watch Mooch. Why don't you tell people where they can find you here on the Fire and Water Network?
Well, as you said, you can find me here on the Fire and Water Network. I do have a few podcasts of my own that have been sleeping Cthulhu-like for a while,
You
but
got a
they
big
were.
inch level of dust on him, Max.
I know, and hopefully they will come back as soon as life stops being so
Oh,
wacky.
yes, that's in the near future.
But yeah, sure. Why not? But yeah, but you can also find me. I am a co-host of The Sandman Slept Here, which is a fairly new show, with Ryan Daly and Paul Kien. And we are talking about Sandman Mystery Theater, but the Vertigo series from the 90s, which has been a lot of fun.
It's a great show. That I hadn't read much of that comic, and it's been a lot of fun listening to you guys talk about it because I'm learning lots of new things about the book and about the art, the art, a whole bunch of new stuff. So it's great, and I'm just happy to hear your voice on the
No.
network. So we're happy about that. So, well, again, thank you so much for coming back. I really appreciate it. Thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of this show on our website, FireAndWaterPodcast.com, and you can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. You can find the show over on Blue Sky at Fade Out Pod. If you want to leave a review on the iTunes Apple Podcast page of the show, we really would appreciate it. It helps. There's a million movie podcasts, so it would help. Every review helps. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Monique D, Don McWaters, Mark Balbus, plus David Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, Al, and Mike Atchison for their support of Fade Out and the Fine Water Podcast Network. One other thing I want to mention, just as a promotion for myself, if you don't mind, everybody. By the time this show will be airing at the end of November, which means the next one will be at the end of December. So between the two episodes, will have been doing, is that a sentence? I will have done another film intro this time for one of my favorite movies of all time, White Christmas, back at the Tampa Theater. I'm very excited about that. I love that movie, and I had to fight to get my intro down to a reasonable length because there's so much I want to say about that movie. And on the audio commentary front, I did the audio commentary for the Australian release from a label called Umbrella Entertainment for Quest for Fire, the 1981 caveman movie that I actually saw as a kid in the theater. My dad took me to see it, even though it was rated R. I did the commentary track for that. It's certainly to this point the biggest movie I've been associated with, and it was great fun. And obviously, most of you probably can't even play the Australian Blu-rays unless you have a region-free player. But in case you do and you like that movie and you want to hear me talk about it, go ahead and pray. It comes out on December 3rd. I'm very, very, very excited about it because, like I said, I'd never done a movie to that size when I got the gig, and it was really great fun to do it. So that's going to be out and available. And just to gather self-promotion, you can hear clips of every audio commentary I've ever done over on my personal website, which is robkellycreative.com. So, all right, enough plugging. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back with another episode next month, but we've reached the end of this particular script. So for now, it's time to fade out.
Oh, Rocky's really mad now. Why? Why, it's Mugsy. Don't look at me like that, Mugsy. I'm your pal, Mugsy, your buddy pal. Yeah.
It's for you, Rocky. Chitons.
No. No, not that. No, no.
Chitons, you understand? Chitons. Here.
Oh, they're adorable.